Welcome to the New Front Door podcast, with practical advice and fundamental principles to help churches and Christian ministries communicate, promote, plan, and support loving community and gospel proclamation. For more information, visit newfrontdoor.org.
Well, welcome to a New Front Door podcast, where we're picking up a conversation that was recorded last year, just as a lot of the mainstream media was beginning to talk about this new developments in generative AI of various kinds. And that was a very much a, what is this technology? What is it not? What are some of the positive and, non-scary ways of thinking about it as an everyday tool? We're now 12 months into this like broad public conversation and 12 months into a lot of people having used it in a whole bunch of ways, and a whole bunch of different kinds of conversations or documentaries or YouTubes or podcasts that people may have come across. And so we're picking up this podcast with a new bunch of guests to, again, discuss this new tech. And I think possibly less on a just a what is it and what are some everyday ways of understanding and using it. Much more the focus today will be plumbing into a bit more depth about, well, how do we use it and think about it in a way that honors God and loves others and restrains its worst potential, harnesses its best? That's the kind of area we'll be going in. But let's meet our panel. So I'm Mikey Lynch, one of the members of the board for the New Front Door Ministry, Church IT Guild. I'm also the editorial director with Gospel Coalition Australia and work with AFES Uni Student Group leading the team here in Hobart at UTAS. I'll just go around the circle as I see it. So Nathan Campbell, tell us a little bit about yourself.
Yeah, I'm Nathan Campbell. I'm a Presbyterian pastor in inner city Brisbane in Queensland. I've been doing that for about 10 years. Prior to that, I worked in public relations, and I have a blog where I write things that are verbal processing the world, I guess, called stuticus.com. Mm. At the moment, it's just a vehicle for my sermons being turned into text, but in the past, I've written a bit about AI and media and thinking about how we as Christians use it and don't use it and what it's for.
Yeah, yeah, cool. And so, and I mean, all of you guys, I think you're coming in with this, you're people who are, what's the word? I don't know, like you're public intellectuals in the sense that you're people who are in public trying to think deeply and seriously. Mm. You know, and definitely Nathan's been doing that for years and years. So is Arcos. Tell us a bit about yourself, Arcos.
Yeah, hi, Arcos Balog of Time to Transition at the moment, but previous hats I've worn recently, I headed up the external engagement team at Moore College, where I started using AI and put together some AI frameworks for Moore College to use amongst the staff on the staff side of things. Prior to that, I was working with the Gospel Coalition Australia, and I'm still on the editorial panel for that. And also got a ministry background as well with AFES. I blog at arcosbalog.com, and like Nathan, it's really a case of thinking out loud, trying to put these thoughts out into the world, helping people understand the world from a Christian perspective. And recently, as mentioned, I've also been blogging about AI as well.
Yep, and Paul Matthews.
Yeah, well, I'm a high school history teacher. That's the predominant hat I wear for most of my life. However, this year I've pivoted and I'm the CEO and co-founder of a tech startup called My Teacher Aid. And our big goal is to be able to make teaching the rich experience that it once was. So we know a lot of people get into the profession. I should say I'm a big fan of Christian education. So I love it, and it really pains me when I see people burn out of the profession. So people get in to inspire the next generation. This is the big idea behind My Teacher Aid. However, they leave the profession often less than 5 years in because they're burnt out from the busy work.
It's not for the teaching though, is it? Yeah, it's for other
things. Yeah, that's right. They're burnt out. So my vision for AI, and this will bleed through into our conversation, I'm sure, is I think we can leverage it to allow us to take care of a lot of busy work that we're doing. And so we can actually get back to doing the things that we love doing. And in that case, for teachers, it's inspiring the next generation of students.
Yeah, and that does bleed right into the where I want to begin with this, is that part of the reason why I'm keen for you guys all to sort of be sharing your thoughts is you've all played around with this stuff in various ways, and it's a lot more than play for you, Paul. You've actually really thrown in a lot of effort into trying to get this My Teacher's Aid thing going. So And look, there's a little play on words in A, by the way, right? It's AI, capital AI, D.
Right? Yeah, that's right. More of a visual gag, so not that well suited to the podcast medium, but you're absolutely – I appreciate you teeing that up for me, Mikey.
So it's more than playing around for Paul, but all of you guys have had a pretty serious interest in various kinds of tech over the years, including this stuff. And so I thought we would begin, like with what Paul's just mentioned, a very practical example of. You might want to hear a bit more about that in a sec, but – maybe the other two share some of those positive. What's the gains you've seen with this kind of tech? And that can be fun and silly right through to some stuff that you've gone, hey, this is really whatever, say with more college staff or with your own personal day-to-day, this has actually really been a helpful thing for you. Anything you want to share, Nathan, Arcos?
Yeah. I mean, for me, I'll cut to the chase. I think the where I've landed with AI is to think about it, certainly ChatGPT, I think that's the main tool I'm using, is to think of it like a digital intern. So somebody who is there to help you, but someone that you need to train. So you can't just give it a simple instruction and expect it to put out a great result. ChatGPT certainly, and I'm guessing other AI as well, is something that you need to prompt well, you need to give good instruction to. So certainly with ChatGPT, you need to give very clear instructions, detailed prompts. And while it is getting better, I think it's still at stage that the more detailed your prompts are, the better the output will be. So, for example, in my previous role, I was working in a marketing space. And so giving it prompts about so actually telling ChatGPT, for example, that you are an expert marketer. You are marketing to an audience of Christians that are interested in thinking about the big issues of life. Come up with 10 ideas for articles that could be written in this space. And so that level of detail, the more granular the detail, the better. But again, digital intern, a co-pilot, something to help you with your work.
Now, out of interest on that, for those who haven't used this stuff so much, once you've done that, some of that background work once, does it remember that stuff for future prompts, or are you having to cut and paste those detailed prompts each time you come back to it?
Yeah. With ChatGPT, you can start a new conversation. So a new conversation is how it works. It works in conversations. My understanding is, and I'm happy to be corrected, but my understanding is that within the same conversation, it does remember the details you've given it. But if you start a new conversation, then you need to give it new information as well.
Mm-hmm. Nathan.
Yeah, look, I think in the IT world, I'm kind of adjacent to it rather than in it, but I understand there's black hat testers of different technology. I like to think I've been a bit of a white hat tester of AI tools. So trying to figure out what uses there are that we might explore as Christians, and particularly for me in the church context, thinking about not just how we as Christians think about technology and use it well, but how church leaders and church communities use these tools in the life of the church. And there's big ethical questions and all that. I'm sure we'll get to that. But for me, I've used Midjourney quite a lot, which is an image generator. I've used it to design my sermon series graphics for the last year and a half, replacing a Shutterstock subscription with Midjourney. And then I've spun off that into my kids and I have a little T-shirt company, Solid Rock Shirts, where we design cute pictures of cartoon animals doing weird things and turn them into a shirt using a dropshipping company. And people can order their designs online. So we're using that to talk through technology and some business and marketing principles, and that's been really fun. So there's a lot of things. I've used ChatGPT quite a bit for things like I developed a church in a box marketing kit, a brand style guide, website. I got it to code the website for me. I can talk a bit more about the experience of that and what it actually produces later. But there's lots of things that it can do if you think to ask it. I turned it into a text-based adventure game in the world of Robin Hood, where you play as Friar Tuck and had to launch a reformation, and that was a bit of fun for a few days. there's all sorts of ways that you can think out of the box. I've played with trying to get ChatGPT to describe the Mona Lisa and then copying and pasting that description into Midjourney to see what sort of picture gets pumped out. It's been fun to play around with and see what's possible and to try to break it, basically, to push it to its limits. I've got to confess this. I copied and pasted a bunch of Arcos's articles into ChatGPT and tried to make an Arcos that would write me articles about straight line and jagged line approaches to ethical issues, including whether or not to butter cheese toast So I had a lot of fun with that and then pitched it to Mikey as a Gospel Coalition article, and he just has this sort of AI produced anything, basically.
So, I mean, it's really interesting. All of these are examples, and maybe we can then loop back to maybe a specific example of what your company is trying to do, Paul. But they're examples, again, of working with the staff with a human dimension there. So with you and your kids, for example, you guys are bringing in ideas of what you'd like to see or in your sermon series, and then when it comes up with something, you're going, oh, that's not quite what I want. That wouldn't quite work for us. Try again. And so there still is this, you know, you're I guess, like someone going back 10 years, mucking around with an advanced synthesizer tool going, I want this thing to give me this sound that sounds exactly like the 80s. So not quite it. How do I adjust the levels to get it? So what's a concrete thing that at this burned out, near burned out, disillusioned Christian school teacher gets you My Teacher's Aid subscription, is it, or whatever it is? What's one concrete thing that will help them in like a month or so's time as they're getting in the classroom? What's a concrete example of how I'm assuming it's going to be similar sorts of things. What's an example of what it looks like?
Well, sure. One of the things that I think teachers feel most burnt out about is the things that really cooks their goose is that they know they've got a more diverse group of learners in their classroom than ever before. And the stats post-COVID are really, really clear. The learning gap, the gap between the highest achiever in the class and lowest achiever in the class academically, is bigger than it's ever been. And so what does that mean? It means that you might have someone in your grade 10 history class, I had this, someone who's probably at a first-year university level, and someone who's probably at a grade 5 or 6 reading level. Now, what does that mean? Well, it means that if I want to give a meaningful education to either of those two people and everyone in between, I need to be thinking about creating custom and tailored resources, whether we're reading journal articles or newspapers, whether I'm giving assignments that I want to be able to extend up or differentiate down. That's just
otherwise,
time
it feels
I don't
like you're
have.
Kind of punishing a kid with worksheets. It's like you're punishing me for being too smart by doing like these kind of throwaway worksheets rather than actually extending me. Yeah.
You're exactly right. And so My Teacher Aid, the big vision is not that we allow teachers to do a week's worth of work in 7 minutes so they can play more golf. It's actually there's a list as long as our arm of things that we can do for our students that we haven't been able to because we haven't had the time. And that also extends to Christian practices we know are so valuable, thinking, pondering, wondering, prayer and reflection, things that simply there is no time in the calendar. But if I'm able to do 4 hours worth of differentiating a text for my various student body, if I can do that in 5 minutes, well, there's a little bit of time left over for the reflection and the prayer and the pondering and wondering that I've been not able to get to for the last month or two. So that's what I anticipate, Mikey, not less time doing stuff, but actually being able to press into the things that are really going to make the difference for our students.
Yeah, so you've highlighted again an interesting thing, isn't it, that actually there's another change in our social world for good, which is aiming for inclusivity, but inclusivity places this immense pressure often on the people, you know, under-resourced school trying to facilitate the inclusivity, and so this stuff can actually – and, I mean, we haven't mentioned language other than English and all that, but that's another level of that too, isn't it, where the translation of these tools is better than what we're used to with previous things, yeah.
Let me give you one really concrete redemptive aspect of AI. So I've got a student in my Year 9 history class from last year. He's fresh from mainland China, and he would have got absolutely nothing out of my year – and my syllabus. However, what I was able to do using AI, I was able to upload our textbook chapter into Canva, of all things, and it translated it from Mandarin into English. It translated the text, translated the graphs, translated the tables. Now, that's I've got some questions about, you know, the data security and whatnot, but I do know for that one student, it made a world of difference. And he went from where he would have been just picking a scab in the back of the room, and he was actually integrated in our learning. And it's that sort of thing I see as a highly redemptive aspect of this AI.
But let's move back to then thinking about as we dream. I mean, you immediately think about your Bible translators, hey? Like my church supports a guy who's been working at a software that basically facilitates a regular QWERTY to function as a keyboard for any language, you know, in order to get the Bible into more languages in the world. And his software, which was originally a mission software, has increasingly become just useful in general for helping, you know, less resourced peoples of the world in general literacy and empowerment and stuff. These tools are going to really speed that up. You know, if you talk to doctors about the speed with which we can now address medical research issues. Or did you guys hear the one about the charcoal preserves of scrolls from one of those ancient volcanic eruptions that one of these tools was able to
scan through the layers to find
catch the difference of the ink in order to then start reading scroll. You know, we may uncover lost texts through this. Yeah. So, I mean, any things you guys either on the, you know, like in the broader media or closer to home, some of those other kind of cool, you know, redemptive, you could say, stories. We've just lost Arcos. He's gone to audio only, but hopefully we can still hear him all right. Yeah, Nathan or Arcos, any other stories you can think of that beyond your immediate experience where you go, wow, this is really helping the world in an awesome way?
Oh, look, I think while Arcos is offline, I think in the fields of there's all sorts of business and efficiency fields where algorithms are going to be able to make better decisions with big data that we just can't process. Pattern recognition, that sort of work, it's phenomenal at that. It's that the STEM fields rather than the humanities fields are probably where it's going to be strongest. And there's plenty of intersection between Christian ministries and those fields where it's just reproducing mechanical work to create efficiencies. That's been the promise of every technology ever, though. So we'll be careful how optimistic and excited we get.
Yeah. If you can hear me, I mean, one of the most promising things I've heard is thinking about each individual person getting their own chatbot, which is like a coach, like a tutor. So I think about students, if we're thinking of school students, with their own tutor that can help them with all their homework, all their assignments and so forth, but then adults as well, life skills, that sort of thing. So that's, some sort of chatbot like that would be quite helpful in many ways. But, of course, it comes with ethical questions as well, like would you take advice from a robot and that sort of thing.
All I was going to say is it's very interesting. I remember a line off Mythbusters way back in the day. I don't know if you gentlemen remember that, where they just talk about really elegant solutions to problems that they themselves have created. And it's one of those things. I'm a big fan of AI. I love it, and I've obviously built a business around it. However, I think it's one of those things. I've recently been engaging with some people online about AI girlfriends, and if ever there was an example of a something that was a solution to a problem that it itself caused, we've got now a technology that is aimed at meeting mainly lonely men between the ages of 18 and 38. And why are they lonely? Well, actually, they're very isolated because of things like internet pornography and chat rooms and all these sorts of things. So it's, like I said, there's some fantastic solutions out there to problems caused by the very thing that's sort of the remedy.
I began the last one of these for the New Front Door podcast quoting from the famous Terminator 2 description of the AI revolution and when Skynet became sentient and so on. But there's another, I mean, it's a killer movie. It's such a good movie. There's another great section of Terminator 2 where Sarah Connor is watching young John Connor playing with Arnold Schwarzenegger as the Terminator when they're out at this sort of desert compound. Her voiceover says, watching John with the machine, it was suddenly so clear. The Terminator would never stop. It would never leave him. It would never hurt him, never shout at him or get drunk and hit him or say it was too busy to spend time with him. It would always be there, and it would die to protect him. All the would-be fathers who came and went over the years, this thing, this machine, was the only one who measured up. In an insane world, it was the sanest choice. So this takes us to this question we're already nibbling at, which is like, well, what are the limits? Tech does things to us whether we like it or not. Like there's a sense in which we will be changed by this, whether we fancy we're being changed by it or not. How do we, as it's happening around us, think about this? I mean, you talked about the girlfriends or coaches Arcos talked about. There are certainly going to be cases where people with high anxiety or certain kinds of neurodiversity issues where the relational power of these tools will be enormously helpful, otherwise largely neglected people in care facilities will get neurological and social benefits from interacting with these things. And yet immediately you go, won't that just mean, won't the logic of the market say, well, if you can do it for free using machines, why bother sending human beings to, you know, let's send the machine to go and chat to Nan. She won't know the difference. And then you roll that out on a social level, at, you know, in all sorts of ways, it becomes an issue. I mean, surely already people are hanging out with their ChatGPT that they've trained to hang out with and keep them company on the way to work. Doubtless that's already a thing. What's the boundaries here from, I mean, I don't know, I hang out with a cast of Stranger Things when I really watch an episode of that. I like the predictability. I like them. I feel like I know. I don't know. How do we think, what's this now? This is ethically and spiritually and Christianly as individuals, but then how do we preach about this and parent the next generation about this, and maybe where we can, like business owners and teachers and pastors, influence a society in a small way? Where are you guys at with this stuff? It's hard to know where to begin. I know you've all done some thinking on it. Nathan, go. You made the voice first.
I've done some preaching on it as well, actually. I think this is, I know it's part of a bigger suite of things going on in our culture in terms of what some people have called the machine, the kind of technological age, the idea that we can fix and make a better world through our ingenuity. And that there's people who for ages have been studying this in the realm of media, but also just thinking about technology. So Marshall McLuhan, who is a kind of founder of this discipline called media ecology, Neil Postman, who is one of his kind of followers, both of them wrote from a religious perspective about the mythic or idolatrous kind of capacity of technology, the way that it embeds in its forms a certain view of the world. And so I think it's really important that we think about that, not just with AI, but with any technology or practice we introduce into our ecosystems, our habits, our bodies, and the way that we are formed. So AI is just another one of those where if you haven't thought about how you're going to do it, you can get swept up in some pretty compelling myth-making by people with a pretty big agenda to make a stack of money. And so there's a lot of AI hype that is directly related to how much money has been invested in AI companies and how much they need to make that back. And so you just got to kind of sift through what's real and what's not, and bring it to bear, or bring the Christian story to bear against it. And I guess the kind of meta narrative of the Bible about idolatry and how it deforms us as humans are taking us away from representing God to representing ourselves. So the Babel story, Isaiah, and the stuff about idol making, and is not this thing in my right hand a lie? I've done some writing for CPX and for some other outlets about that kind of dynamic of the market and its agendas with AI. There's an old thought experiment with tech, the infinite paperclip machine, which is this thought experiment where if you train a machine to turn everything into paperclips and it's just got to maximize the number of paperclips it makes, it will eventually turn everything into paperclips. It'll start with the available resources in the ground and move to other machines that have been made from metal, and then go for your artificial knees and eventually figure out a way to turn people. If you don't have restraints or limits built into the system will grab hold of everything and destroy it. And if at the moment the limits in the system, they're there because there's political limits that'll stop ChatGPT spitting out hate speech. They've learned from Microsoft's Hey that turned racist in a day, I think. But yeah, we've got to be thoughtful in how we bring this technology in and be shaped by a different set of habits and beliefs and a different ecology, even a different set of things in our world that give us meaning, so that when we come to this tool, it has a place, but it doesn't become totalizing and idolatrous and mythological. I don't know, I've probably rambled a bit. Keen to hear the other guys.
Let's move into ramble mode a bit, and I'm happy to let this become a bit of a conversation at this point. So chime in, guys, as we go from here.
Yeah. I think one of the big questions for me, and I think one of the big questions we need to grapple with as Christians, is in the early centuries after Christ, the big question was, who is God? What's the nature of God, Trinity? What's the nature of Christ? I think the big question for today is, what does it mean to be human? So today, technology has gotten to the point where it can emulate or start to emulate humanity. And as Mikey said, and as Nathan mentioned as well, people are entering into relationships with AI. So replica.com, a website, Replica with a K, has supposedly millions of subscribers where you can subscribe and actually have a AI girlfriend or boyfriend. And people are finding it very helpful, you know, people that are lonely and so forth. I think, as Paul mentioned, there's a lot of people in that category that are really looking to this. But I think the big question is, what does it mean to be human? And therefore, what does it mean to relate to non-human entities? I mean, where I've landed with this, having thought about it a little bit, is to say that as human beings, the Bible's quite clear that we're made in the image of God. That makes us unique and different to animals and the rest of creation. And so that we are made for relationship, obviously with God vertically, horizontally with other image bearers and with creation as well. But there's a uniqueness to our relationships with others, that we should not get other things like creation or, in this case, AI, to replace our relationships with other image bearers. I think where the push of the Bible would be is that bad things can happen if that is the result, no matter how much that AI emulates us. I think certainly currently AI doesn't do a very good job of emulating a real human being, but I suspect that in the future, in, you know, 5, 10, 20 years, I suspect we're going to live in a world where we won't know the difference between whether we're talking to a real person, certainly online, but even perhaps, you know, depending on how androids go, in real life even, that's going to raise those issues. But I think the bottom line for me is, or the big question for me is, what does it mean to be a human being, and therefore how do we do our relationships as human beings?
Interesting to think about proper limits, isn't it, in the sense that trying to understand why the Bible forbids certain kinds of things like necromancy or, you know, talking to dead people, you know, summoning up dead people like the Witch of Endor apparently does for Saul, or talking with angels and demons. Why are these things, why are there limits on these things if they're just other sentient beings you could talk with and ask questions of? And I guess the Bible assumes there are proper limits of various kinds. There comes a point when you breach into the heavens or you breach into the dead where you're going beyond a proper limit, and God is the one who and his messengers are the ones, only ones, who bridge that thing. I guess all tech raises that question, including biotech and information tech, where you go, what are the appropriate limits for this, and where do the limits become in it? Just like, I guess, anyone in student ministry has to have conversations about, like, breaking up over SMS only, or handling relationships and conflicts entirely through indirect mediums. There comes a point where that's not, you know, that there may be times when that's all you can do. But there are other times when you go, oh, is that actually the best and right and most honourable thing to do? Well, I guess we'll have to keep having that question over and over again. At what point is this? It's not a question of what's, you know, measurable in a brute, effective, efficient, clumsy sense, but it's a deeper thing, right? To go, patients may demonstrate no awareness that they're talking to a robot, but do we want to be a society where patients only talk to robots? That's a different kind, order of question, isn't it, this proper boundary business, proper conduct thing?
I think I came to hear from Paul, but I've got some stuff to say off the back of Arcos, so I don't know how you want to do that.
I'm happy to offer just a few cursory observations on what has been said there. One of the interesting themes we see over again in the scriptures is that, so to skip actually a couple of 1.5 millennia after the scriptures, Calvin, the classic Calvin line that everyone pulls out of their back pocket in every sermon they mention Calvin, the human heart is an idol factory, right? And so what we've got to realize that one of the chief temptations we have is a species of technophilia where we make an idol. And the scriptures tell us often, you see it in the Psalms many times, people who worship idols become like them. And we have this idea of people becoming deaf and dumb, like a block of wood. Well, I think we really do need to watch out. I think in the wordplay is almost poetic, but I think we do need to watch out for an over-reliance on artificial intelligence that leads us to become artificial people. So Arcos is talking about what it means to be human, and I think we can actually dehumanize ourselves if we start outsourcing. One of the interesting things also when it comes to AI companionship, be that the AI girlfriend or boyfriend, we know, because I've heard some Christians say, yes, we are built for relationship, people are isolated, this is going to be a useful tool to reintegrate people. But actually, again, this is where we have to press back into the scriptures, because if we're not easy, as Nathan said, every technology comes with an idea. What does an AI girlfriend come, what idea is deeply embedded and shaping that technology is that you need to have your desires and whims sort of supplicated. You need to have someone meet your needs. Actually, what does our Lord say? He says it's more blessed to give than receive. He says it's not about me having my needs met all the time. Actually, what makes me human and engenders me into relationship with other people and gives me deep and rich relationships is not what I get, but what I give. And I'd want to say to those people, what can you give to an algorithm? What can you give to a robot? I'd say nothing. They're not made in the image of God. And I'd say you're actually going to, you're not just getting a normal relationship, but 10% less. It's not just a slight degree, matter of degree. It's a whole different category. And it's I would say that's actually not how God wants us relating to people.
Yeah, look, I shouldn't have let Paul go because he said almost exactly what I was going to say. And I don't know what your rating on this podcast is, Mikey, but I think with the this is fascinating thing. This is part of where I went in my sermon series. It was on being human.
The AI term. Let's call it a technical term. So it's not actually a crass word. It's a formal technical term.
But the chatbots, the relationship chatbots, there are people actively trying to make sex robots that will integrate a digital consciousness. So you'll have an embodied thing that's designed to meet your every desire. I wrote some stuff for CPX on digital images. So the Midjourney, but if it was unrestrained and you could produce any pornographic image you could imagine, what's the ethics of that? Because you're removing the human from the production floor, which is like it's an industry that's exploitative and destructive and horrid for the people involved. Surely that somehow ethically better would be one way that people have talked about digitally produced stuff. But it ends up being a disembodying and dismembering thing that makes images that are composites of thousands of women. But it's more about what it does to us as we use it, I think. That kind of you become what you behold. Your imagination, your desires are shaped by the images that you encounter. And we produce these images that aren't made in the image of God, which is us, but images that are made in our image that we then become like. It's this vicious cycle, especially when there's other agendas at play behind the scenes and behind these tools. And so you read a book like The Age of Surveillance Capitalism by Shoshana Zuboff, which talks about the way that the technology we use is always built to make money for someone and always built to perpetuate the inequalities that are there with the haves and the have-nots. So the people are going to be replaced by AI-powered robots in nursing homes are your low-income, marginalized people, and they're not going to get better jobs as a result. They're going to get no jobs. And so there's this systemic thing built in, and actually what we are giving ourselves as we interact with this technology, or sorry, what we're giving to the algorithm is we're giving ourselves, we're giving our data in ways that then gets fed back in this feedback loop to give us more of what we want and to addict us more and to plug us in more and to disconnect us more from the real world and from God. And so I think there's a real sinister thing in the mix, and you might talk about powers and principalities with this idolatry, this worship that distorts and deforms our humanity and takes us into really destructive places as individuals and as a society.
There's an interesting version of it, like that line where there's somewhere to go into older tech of like video games and stuff. Like there's some people that say, oh, any violent video game is by definition bad. I think there's a case that can be made that within the rules of the game itself, you know, there's a place for, you know, games that involve violence and because the world involves challenges that feature violence, and so that violence may not be illegitimate violence, but maybe force, blah blah blah. Like there's that kind of argument. What I think my wife and I began to particularly be cautious about though with our kids was the open world game, where it was no longer within the rules and objectives of the game to a purpose, but where you could also take your character off map and just do whatever violent, harsh thing to some rant, like a GTA type game, Grand Theft Auto, where you can just start beating up some random pedestrian non-player character. And that's, they're not a person. They're not feeling anything. It's not doing anything bad to any actual person. But because you've suddenly, you're no longer in this linear game, you're choosing to just, you know, it's doing something to you, Nathan, like you said. I guess it's the beginning of that kind of Westworld type trajectory, to use that TV show, where
there's a fascinating...
Yeah.
Yeah, the fascinating thing I read about GTA, there's this whole subculture of subversion with those sorts of games that wants to play as a pacifist or non-violent. So there's no kill runs of games like Skyrim. But there was a dad who got his four-year-old son playing GTA.
As well, I think.
So dad was playing GTA with his four-year-old and told him it was an emergency services game. We just had to help the police and the fire department do things. And so there's actually something about the heart that we bring to this technology that will shape the experience we have of it, and that's important. We don't want to kind of say the technology is evil, we can't use it. It's more sophisticated than that. It's about what myths, what stories about the world we're buying into as we use it and perpetuate.
And even with those, that sex toy type stuff, there's probably in the niche world of therapeutic stuff, probably some perfectly like it's a, I don't want to have to, but you can imagine there'll be areas there that also has a it properly regulated, restrained, blah blah blah. It has a narrow function that's good and right, but that becomes the arguing of multiple evils, doesn't it? The evils, horrible evils of sex slavery of you know pornographic industry and stuff versus this lesser but still mutating evil of using tech the way it's going. It's interesting how much does it force us in a sense? We've been in a way for a few centuries of what's made democracy possible, what's made free-ish societies possible has been ready access to information, education, publication, photography, video, all of that has made evidence and verification and accountability possible in a way that restrains power and empowers individuals. If this tech gets sufficiently effective, we're almost getting that rewound, aren't we? So we're no longer, we're kind of in a sense pre-printing press, definitely pre-photograph in terms of how effective the law courts can be, how effective the citizenry can be in holding their rulers to account, how much we could ever know about what another country actually has said or done. We just have to rely, that's been, I guess, most of human history, hasn't it? And even economically, if so many jobs get swallowed up, where are you left to? I guess there's more subsistence forms of living and employing. Yes, I don't know. Like they're interesting things to contemplate, isn't it? How there's this weird digital dark ages potentially for a bunch of people and for whole societies potentially.
Yeah, that's right. I think we're at a bit of a crossroads, or we're approaching a bit of a crossroads in terms of how we view this technology. So one way of viewing it, I think we've discussed, is more as a human-centered, co-pilot. AI is there to help and augment humanity as we do our work. Or then there's the idea that AI is there to replace humanity. And as soon as, I guess, Nathan's mentioned the market and so forth, as soon as the market can price out a human being and get an AI there instead, well, the AI will replace the work. So I think there's real concerns there as to where this is all heading. So I think as a society, we're at a crossroads. What vision of AI do we want to implement into our world? Is it going to be a vision like, I guess, a calculator, for example, that frees us up to be able to do other things and takes away some of the drudge work? Or is it going to be something that actually replaces us in toto? So there's some big questions and big uncertainties there.
And I think one of the key things we must watch out for this discussion is people thinking that because we're in a brand new age, new morality must apply. We must take new worldview principles and approach this with a new framework. And the opposite is actually true. I was just saying to Mikey today as we met on a walk, I actually think in this day and age, with a huge range of what's possible, and we've touched on some of that already, I'm coming at this as a school teacher. We need to be taking the formation of our young people and everyone in our churches, everyone in our communities. I think the way that we navigate this brave new world is with the same ancient morality that has always been so important. And in fact, I think that sort of moral fiber and moral enthusiasm is more important now than ever. I was just saying to Mikey, I was saying, do you know what my grandpa had to do to avoid pornography in his high school years? Nothing. He didn't have to do anything. He wafted through. He could have had a complete lack of moral enthusiasm and he wouldn't have seen a skerrick of pornography. Now, what about the year 9 and 10s that I'm teaching? completely different scenario. The level of honor and valor, the level of temperance and self-control is way, way higher. They need to be twice the man, perhaps, that my pa needed to be to avoid these pitfalls. The pitfalls, of course, were there before, but the availability of them has just skyrocketed. And so that's why I actually think that we as Christians, we need to be doubling, tripling down on the fact that character is a vital component, if not the vital component, to navigating this new world, because without it, we'll just fall prey to the same vices that have captured people for millennia.
So Nathan's talked about already beginning to preach about it. You guys are writing or tweeting about it. We've already begun talking then, yeah, what are some of the things we need to teach? It's so tricky because we don't know fully. And there's so much out of our control, right, in terms of what regulation happens, how it gets managed, what limits get put on these things. So in a sense, part of the discipling we need to do now, this is why it's great that Paul's raised this stuff, is kind of we're circling around deeper principles or values. I wonder, could we've all lived through the disruptive but less disruptive kind of internet web 2.0, you know, where the generations who experienced that transition happening as we were coming to adulthood, and there was less disruptive than this stuff looks like it will be, but still there's some comparative things, isn't there? There's people who just said, oh, that's all horrible, terrible, you know, like denouncing a pastor, yeah. Denouncing it.
Although
saying, Plato, oh, use Facebook just to do lots of Bible verse quotes, and that's the way to use Facebook or something.
Plato said that about the written word though as well. So it's not like he said that'd ruin our memories and change us so that we're, you know, relying too much on things that are written down, not on our brain.
What
so
there's a for the last 20 years, having experienced the internet thing, I mean, on one level we learnt to some extent. The Facebook deniers, they kind of were half right. And we've all ended up a bit where they are. So, you know, that's interesting, isn't it, that you know, Luddites they play a helpful part in the social world, but they were only half right because there have also been awesome things about social media. Reflections on what we can learn from the last couple of decades of watching the world and the church respond to the internet and social media?
Yeah, if I could jump in, I think the big thing for me is to realise that Nathan's mentioned Marshall McLuhan, someone who's talked about how technology shapes us. So it's not just a case of can we put good content or bad content on social media? That's an extremely simplistic way of thinking about it. It's what is this social media doing to us as we use it? And I think, you know, what has it done as we look across society? It's made us, you know, in terms of our engagement with others, the level of outrage has grown. The algorithms obviously have started feeding us stuff that makes us more outraged. You know, it started dividing society. We get into our own echo chambers and silos. So as we look back, I think we need to realise that technology does shape us, and that shaping isn't always good. So I think as we look ahead, for me, I think the big question is, well, what are the values or ideas, I think as Paul mentioned, that AI brings with it? What values does it have? And how is that going to shape us as we engage with it? And obviously we're still, you know, it's a work in progress. We're still thinking about it. But it does mean that I think there's a level of caution that we need to have, especially looking back at the social media, as we start engaging and thinking about it.
Yeah, good call.
Yeah, I'd also say that one thing we can learn is that the catastrophizers are often not correct. I've come again from a teaching perspective. Neil Postman, incredibly useful person. We may well touch on his dichotomy between the additive and ecological change that technology makes, and that's a useful distinction. But the thing about Postman is he also thought that the TV was going to replace the teacher, and you can read about that in some of his work. And, you know, as someone who's in the classroom right now, you just go, man, like for the incredible wisdom that some of these talking heads have been and the amazing amount of light, they can just be potato heads in other areas. So, no, I'm not going to get my knickers in a knot if Neil Postman said that my career won't exist in 10 years, because they're often wrong. People have said that with the TV, obviously Postman. People said that it was actually the laptop or the internet or even the encyclopedia which would replace teachers. There have been people, for whatever reason, people have been trying to talk about replacing teachers for a very long time, yet what do we see actually? We need teachers more than ever right now, and obviously I'm quite heavily within that domain because that's my professional setting. But I wouldn't be too quick to phone it in and say, well, I'm just going to take it easy and kick the clutch in and hope to collect that universal basic income check in 2 years. I'm not so convinced that the society is going to change in the radical ways that many people have been prophesying. That's just my take.
And certainly we saw, like, in addition to the problems raised with social media, it also fostered connections and empowered, like, different voices, more grounded voices that otherwise wouldn't have had platforms, led often to face-to-face, you know, kind of meet space friendships or even romantic relationships. They didn't stay online but actually led to meetups in all sorts of ways. And so that's another example where horror stories of social media is only half the story. There are the other great things that it has, like it can create echo chambers, but it can also break down silos as well.
I think there's I think what Arcos was saying is really important, that looking at the values in the tech, but I wonder about the values in the culture that produces the tech as well. I think we need to take a step back. Like, I don't think AI is as new as the markers of AI want us to think it is. There's a strong continuity between it and other technological developments beforehand, and there's often the same people involved in creating this stuff who've been... So Sam Altman, who's the CEO of OpenAI, the ChatGPT company, very connected to Peter Thiel, who created PayPal. There's a network of people in Silicon Valley who all share a vision of the world and of what tech's for, who are all working towards these grand ends, who are all trying to make billions and billions of dollars, are all feeding into a wider societal kind of approach to life that's driven by human ingenuity and our need to save ourselves and to extend our life and even to digitize our consciousness and escape into the cloud. So Musk believes we're already there. He thinks we're already in a computer simulation, and somehow to win the game, you've got to make it possible to be in a computer simulation. Like, it's, if you probe some of their thinking, it's a bit nuts.
Wow.
But yeah. I think once you start probing that thinking, you actually get a more substantive critique that the gospel as a timeless story speaks into, where it's the same old greed and idolatry and self-sufficiency and the desire to be God and to be like God in making images that do our bidding. Like, there's something very human about AI. And there have been people who suggested it's badly named because it's not artificial and it's not intelligent. It's a human creation that just repeats things. And I wonder if the other thing that AI does that we haven't really talked about is in this whole, it functions as an image of sorts, an idol. It also functions as a mirror. One of the things AI does is it reveals our desires and how we function as humans. And when you ask it to write something that seems original, it's purely derivative and based on predictions. And it's actually showing how much what's already out there being pumped out by all sorts of outlets is just that same remixed derivative thing. And that's an Ecclesiastes thing, right? There's nothing new under the sun. It's drawing from the same source material that any artist does when we sit down and make something that's influenced by everyone that's gone before us. There's something about our desire to make some technological thing we make into God, into something like Google that's infinitely able to provide answers to questions.
What's going on there? Is you're doing your T-shirt company then with your kids. So you're playing the game.
Yeah.
So what you're doing, you said you talk about this stuff as you're doing it. So you're not preaching a withdrawal into the hills and build a bunker.
Not the AI Benedict option.
Yeah. You're discussing. Are you discussing with them even? I don't know how old your kids are, man. And when you get discuss this, but do you even discuss the economic impacts of the impact on artists who use more traditional forms of drawing?
Both on those artists and the artists whose work has been scraped and used to produce this. So you could use this tool to reproduce art in the style of any particular artists you wanted to. And so we've talked about how we don't want to do that and we want to leave it quite generic. But even then it's drawing on the work of other people and there's a lack of traceability. And so it is a kind of an ethical minefield that I actually want to be having informed conversations about.
Feel the problematic nature of it, but realise you can't really ever fully withdraw anyway. So instead you've got to how you be informed and aware while realising these tools can be used for good and fun and creativity. And yeah, I've got a T-shirt with a whatever it is on it that, you know, I'm happy to wear and feel proud of. Yeah.
I think another thing to think about here is AI and the technological change, and it's happening more rapidly than ever, and it will continue to speed up. One of the things that does for us as Christians is it gives us a fascinating insight into the secular religion or the common religion, whatever religious impulse people have these days. Everyone is religious. This is just common sort of neo-Calvinism. Everyone is religious. Everyone has a religious impulse. And the big questions that everyone has answers to, whether expressed or implied, are who are we, where are we, what's gone wrong, and how do we fix it? And there's a lot of people today who, when you ask them what's gone wrong, it's we say we're too primitive. We don't have the tech. Or the tech is being withheld from us. And how do we fix our problems? Well, it's with more tech. We layer more technology on. So soon we'll be able to have something that will cure our cancer or solve our loneliness, or it will be able to make this so efficient that there'll be no friction. And actually, we have not only an entire raft of evidence from the 20th and early 21st century to say that, no, actually more tech is not the answer, but it does allow us to share our vision for what's gone wrong and how do we fix it. I think there are some fascinating gospel through lines that we can bring into our technological conversations. The same basic lies that the devil told, people are still believing about technology and AI. What does the devil say? You'll be like God and you won't die. That's what he's saying to people back in the garden. And now people are talking about, what am I going to do with AI? Well, they're yearning like the Dickens to have the USB implanted in the back of their head so they know everything. And they're hoping to have their brain uploaded into the cloud so they don't die. It's the same old lies. And so we've got the same old truth that we can actually apply to this situation. I think it gives us great opportunities to share Christ with people.
Yeah, that's a very Tim Keller sort of thing you're doing there. Yeah.
Yeah. Look, I think the other dynamic in there, I can't say Arcos whether he was about to chime in or not. There's the philosopher Charles Taylor talks about, he's a Catholic and Marshall McLuhan was a Catholic, and both of them had some suspicion about the printing press and what it produced in terms of disenchanting technology that gave everybody a voice when previously the priest had the voice, and now everybody's got a printing press in their phone that can pump out dross and fake news, and it'll be very, very hard to find true things. But one of their other insights was that the more mechanically we view the universe, the more disenchanted we become, and the harder it is to believe, because we keep replacing God with the stuff that we make. I'm just keen to coin this, and this is the podcast that I'm going to do it on. Your friend of mine, Mikey Stephen McAlpine, came up with the secular age as a kind of our society, he thinks, is pushing away from God because of our desires, sexual desires. I think the techular age is actually a bigger deal in terms of disenchanting and secularizing our neighbors than sex even. So I think we turn to technology and technique for solutions. There's a Jacques Ellul kind of bit behind this from the Technological Society, but we are obsessed with solving our problems using our means rather than seeing our existence as in a world that's shot through with transcendence, where we're made to worship and reflect the nature of God. And I think we need to be really careful as we think about discipleship and as we think about the use of these technologies to make sure we've got other things in the mix that are enchanting us rather than pushing us into the machine and onto screens and into a web of pumped out deep fake content that we won't be able to know what's true anymore. It's that balance thing.
Yeah. Yeah. So Arcos is just giving an apology. He's kind of coming in about this might be his holiday tech. I feel like we're converging now on a bunch of points here. That's really helpful. And I guess I'm just pondering as well that face-to-face human connection
enchantment, to some extent, we just will need to continue, we'll have to continually find institutions with integrity as well that mediate all this stuff and preserve access to truth, you know, in competition with fake news and hallucinating AI and all that kind of stuff. So it's going to be an interesting time of looking at what are some of these grounding planks in the world around us. As we finish up, feel free to also share any closing thoughts, but also is there, I mean, we've name dropped a bunch of stuff anyway, but if there was one other thing you'd want to recommend people check out beyond your own blogs and maybe some of the stuff you've mentioned, it can be a YouTube podcast, book, another example of a business or platform. Just if people are kind of curious, and especially if there's anything particularly that addresses that, you know, on the Christian church end of things, but doesn't have to be, have a little think about that. Any closing thoughts you want to have and any recommended reading or watching or listening that you want to pass on to people? I'll kick off with a reading, watching thing. And this has been getting recorded in January 2024. Depending when you listen to this, the book may already come out. But the guy who works for AFES in Canberra, Stephen Driscoll, is currently going through the edits with Matthias Media with a little book on AI stuff that covers a lot of this ground and is deep and thoughtful and substantial enough to be not just a kind of a proof text Bible response to these things. So that would be a great one to check out when it does get published later in 2024. So that'd be my recommend. Anyone else, closing thoughts and recommended place for someone to go next?
No, I
was going to kick it to Arcos. I was going to kick because I can see you're online, man, so you go right ahead. I'm keen to hear from you.
Yeah. Look, an author, someone who speaks in podcasts and so forth, a guy called Tristan Harris, T-R-I-S-T-A-N Harris. He's a guy in America who's thought a lot about media ethics or digital ethics. Secular guy, but he's someone who's now entering the AI space as well. So if you look him up, I know he's got a podcast, it escapes me now, but certainly there's also a website that he has that talks about you can do courses and think through what are the ethical ways of using technology, digital technology, including AI. And there's a lot of resonance there with, I guess, many of the things we've talked about. So Tristan Harris, he's someone that I encourage people to explore.
Thanks, mate. Cool.
Look, what I would say, I guess my closing idea here would be it's very easy for us to pick up this dystopian vision of the world where everything we do is artificial, where we're eating artificial food, we're watching artificial sex, we're having artificial relationships, everything is artificial. And what I have to say, and this could just be my inner very thinly veiled post-millennialism coming out, however, I actually think we are going to reject that. I don't think we are going to go to – I think some people will go down that rabbit hole and it will chew them up and spit them out, but I think human beings will start to crave authentic human relationships. I really think if you're lonely and you are engaging with an AI chatbot, it's going to be like a stranded sailor who's taken a big mouthful of seawater. I reckon it's actually going to do – it's going to look like it will help and it will not help. And I think I have every confidence that God in his faithfulness – well, actually has imbued us with such a deep desire for connectivity and relationship that I think we will reject wholesale artificial engagement with the world. I think it will form part of what we do. All I'm saying here is I don't think it will form all of what we do. I don't think we are going to end up in we're in our big super comfy lounge chair with our giant screen and our big
Wally.
I don't think that's going to happen now. So that's my closing thought. I think we are going to, by God's grace, find ways to use this technology in ways where the trade-offs are worth it for us as a society. I'll point you. I have a podcast, the Christian Education Podcast. It is exactly what it sounds like. But I had the privilege of interviewing a fellow called Derek Sherman. Now, that's Sherman, S-C-H-W-R-M-A-N. If you are from the Kingston Reformed Church, a good Dutch Reformed Church, you call him Derek Schurman. However, he has done some great work. He's been talking about this sort of stuff since the 80s, right? So I strongly recommend, if you want to hear my discussion with him, that's the Christian Education Podcast. He's a lecturer and professor at Calvin University, and you can just search up Derek Schurman AI, and that'll take you right there. There's some great talks that he's done. So I commend those to you.
Nathan.
Mikey, look, final thought. I just keep going back to the way the old story of the Bible has big truths here. And for me, the Tower of Babel is a really interesting one. Humans tried to use human ingenuity and technology to bring heaven on earth, basically. That was their project, to bring glory to themselves. And it all fell apart and got frustrated. But that desire to bring heaven on earth on our own terms is part of what's driving this stuff. And I'm struck by there's a humanitarian kind of response to this technological thing that wants to push back into being more human. I think we actually need to push back into life with God and having heaven on earth on God's terms. And so some of the practices aren't just the practice of communal gathering, but prayer and worship and God-oriented gathering, figuring out what it actually looks like to dwell in the presence of God and listen to him through his word. Those are, I think, the grounding practices that we really need to be cultivating, because that will benefit our human relationships as well as help us put technology in its place. We make technology because we're made in the image of a making God, but we need to be in relationship with God to be doing that. In terms of helpful thinkers, there's I guess plenty of theological thought out there on that front. Dorothy Sayers had a great book, The Mind of the Maker. But there's a media theologian, an Aussie, Victoria Lorimer, who's been thinking about this stuff for years and thought about transhumanism and consciousness and how to approach this stuff. I don't always agree with her ideas, but they're always stimulating. She's been thinking in that space. And there's a guy in my congregation, a guy named Dr. Luke Munn, who's with the Digital Cultures and Society Research Centre at University of Queensland. He publishes some really accessible stuff and good stuff on Twitter, thinking about some of the ethics of AI and those broader questions of how it fits in with other aspects of society and kind of cultural things like surveillance and environment and that sort of stuff. And I think just having an eye to that is really useful, because it helps you not be swept up in the mythology.
It's awesome. And I think that's why it's great having a mix of us, that we're there's so much that we're basically kind of repeating from different perspectives. But I think avoiding like either a simplistic AI doomerism on the one hand, but also not a utopianism on the other hand, but seeing this as perhaps a massive and disruptive, but to some extent Ecclesiastes, like, you know, there'll be much that's not new in the process as well. Thanks heaps for your time, guys. I'll finish us off there, and I'll put a lot of these things into the notes when this goes live, so people can chase up those names and spellings and URLs at their convenience too.
Thank you, Mikey.
Thanks, Mikey.
Thanks Mikey. So much, guys.
This podcast was brought to you by New Front Door, the Church IT Guild. New Front Door exists to help churches and Christian ministries to use IT tools to support IT volunteers, to love people, and proclaim the gospel more deeply, efficiently, and effectively. For more information, visit newfrontdoor.org.